Verses 17 through 19, a command concerning the Amalekites. There you go, pretty simple. We've got two things. This portion, when you go out or when you go forth, it starts off just exactly the same as the chapter before it in verse 20. When you go out to war against your enemies, but it goes on a little differently from there. It starts with going out to war against our enemies at the beginning, and this portion ends at the very end in chapter 25, verses 17 through 19, and going out to war against the Amalekites or Amalek. So the portion is bookended with war or fighting. And there are some practical and some spiritual implications of this bookending. Also, the question mark here at the beginning, not a typo, but we need to consider, what are we going to do with all of these mitzvot or laws or commands, whatever you want to call them, in this section? How do we view them? What are the words that we're going to use for them? So, in an attempt to be a big boy here, I said, well, I can't really let this outline be the only outline I have. I need to really look at this and see, how could I divide all of these seemingly unrelated or hodgepodge or maybe stream of consciousness thoughts into some kind of an outline? So there are 74 mitzvot packed into this chapter. That is the highest concentration of commands in any Torah portion. So this is a Guinness Book of World Records moment, red letter day. We've got a lot of them right here. So I tried to divide them up for us, starting at the beginning, mitzvot concerning the family. You can disagree with how I've divided this. It's okay, but this is what I've got. Mitzvot concerning the family. Mitzvot of dissonance. The next section here, 21, 22 through 22, 12. Mitzvot concerning gender and relations. Mitzvot concerning who's in the club or who's allowed to be a part of the nation and who's not, and governing the army. Mitzvot of personal conduct. Chapter 25, a little bit of a switch there. Judgment before elders. Most of these things that we talked about previous to this are things that you could do personally where it was between you and someone else, but now we are bringing in the elders of the community as being part of the judgment of what's going on. And then finally, in chapter 25, the command concerning the Amalekites. So sandwiched in between these bookends of war, we've got these 74 mitzvot. And what do they all have in common? Can you find a commonality between all of these? Is there something in these 74 that you can see that brings them all together? Don't be afraid to answer. Any ideas? God. Community. I love loaded questions because you know I have an answer. And so your answer might be right, but it might not be my answer. The one thing that I could find that these all had in common is that all of these are on a personal level. They deal with personal conduct, with personal responsibilities, with personal codes, with relationships between people or on a personal level. And this kind of follows the pattern from the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy. Right? Moses, from the beginning of the book, he reviews the history of the nation, and then he goes on through the commands to establish a nation, to establish an economy, to establish national spirituality, to establish governance, right? Last week, Brad spoke about how the kings were to be picked, how governance was supposed to work. So he's kind of working his way down through the nation, and he's now gotten to the end of it, which is us as people. And he says, hey, these are the things that are important between people, that are on a personal level. Also, some people say that the book of Deuteronomy is Moses expounding on the Ten Commandments, expounding and giving more meaning and more life to them, which reminded me. So I remember years ago I was taking some seminary courses, and in the process of this, I had learned that the Greek word for sin was hamartia, which means missing the mark. And so I had learned this concept that, sin, the idea of sin, what is sin? It's missing the mark. It's so the mark was here, right, like a target. It's the bullseye, and we miss it. We go to the side. We don't quite hit what God wants us to hit. And I can remember the professor. He was a great professor. I really liked him. And him talking about how in the Sermon on the Mount, Yeshua was changing. He was kind of resetting the mark of sin for us. Let me read for you a small passage of the Sermon on the Mount from Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So I learned these two concepts together, this idea that, well, sin is missing the mark. And for a long time, it must have been that everybody thought, the mark is, I'm not going to murder. But then along the scene comes Yeshua, and he says, wait a minute. You've got it all wrong. The mark isn't don't murder. It's actually way back here. Don't be angry with your brother. Don't be mad at your brother, but seek a resolution in that, right? For years and years, for centuries, we thought, the mark was don't commit adultery. But when Yeshua comes, he says, actually, the mark's way back here. It's don't be lustful. Don't have lustful thoughts. That's already committing adultery. And this was really impactful to me. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, why didn't somebody do this a long time ago? You're like, why didn't somebody explain this a long time ago? Well, as it turns out, Yeshua wasn't the first one to explain the Ten Commandments. He wasn't the first one to expound on the Ten Commandments. This is, in fact, and indeed, what Moses is already doing here in Deuteronomy. Moses is saying, hey, here's the Ten Commandments. These are the cliff notes. This is just a quick general idea, almost like the table of contents for how we need to organize our lives, how we need to live. And as he goes through the book of Deuteronomy, he says, let me spend a little bit more time explaining a little better what each of these commandments means, what each of these commandments is all about. And so as we've gone through Deuteronomy, we've actually, in this comparison, we've covered commandments, the first five commandments, and in this section of Deuteronomy, we are actually explaining, we are looking into commandments 6 through 10. Right? So commandments 6 through 10 in Exodus 20, starting in verse 12, it says, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. So as we read through the portion this week, Kititze, as we read through these 74 different mitzvot that are listed here, we begin to see an outworking of these commandments within them. We begin to see an outworking as to how each of these commandments work and what it means to live out all of these commandments in a real practical and a real life kind of way. But before we dive into the portion, I want to set up a little bit of framework here of this idea of commandments, these mitzvot, these laws that are found here. Try to define a few terms and try to sort a few things out before we get going. So this is, some of this is kind of new to me. I learned it this week as I was going through this, so I'm kind of at the edge of what I know here with some of this, but I thought it was interesting and wanted to bring it up because I thought it was very helpful for me as I processed through what does it mean to try and live out Torah in my life. So there is this idea of halakha, which is the study of Jewish law. I kind of called it, it could be considered the study of the legislative branch of Judaism, so to speak. It's the idea that we're concerned with, for Jews, both the Torah and the oral law of the rabbis that's been around for centuries. And it expounds on how to observe the law, how to keep it correctly, and how to have some very powerful insights into what the law is and what the law is telling us about. But it can also lead to some serious legalism as well. And I think a few weeks ago, Grant had talked about some of the laws and the outworking and how, you know, like if you opened your refrigerator on Shabbat and the light came on, what did you do? And how did you, you know, how did you deal with that? So this is the idea that halakha has kind of taken on in Judaism, but it is not the actual origin of this word. This word actually can be found here in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 33. You shall walk in all the way that the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live and that it may go well with you, and that you may live long in the land that you shall possess. Where is this word, halakha, where does it appear in this verse? Where do we see it? Yes. In the word walk, right here, walk. Its origin came out of this verse from the word walk. It's not actually, its original intention, its original idea was not actually a legal study or a outworking of these laws in a legal fashion, but it was an idea of walk. How do we walk out? How do we walk out these commands? How do we walk out these things that we are learning? It should be viewed as a guide on our journey. Interestingly here also, this really shows us the play of free will in all of this, that our free will is totally involved in what happens here. We can choose where we walk. We can choose what divine suggestions or commandments we decide to obey or not to obey. This is not a forced thing, but it is something where Adonai is saying, please choose to walk in this way. And here's why. Here's why I want you to walk in this way. Okay, so halakha is the way that you should walk. Mitzvot. Mitzvot are actually just another word for laws. But we need to decide how do we view these mitzvot. Are these laws that we look up in a book, or are these commandments from the mouth of our Creator? So there are 70 plus, 74 probably, of the 613 mitzvot of Torah are in this portion. So I brought all this up to say that this study of halakha is... has identified 613 laws or mitzvot in the Torah and said, hey, these are the things that are important that we need to concentrate on, trying to obey, trying to follow if we want to please Adonai. And 74 of them are found here, packed into this little portion. But how we view them is really going to affect how we view this portion. Right? I had a question mark on this beginning because it's a legitimate question. Laws, if we think about laws, laws tend to be something that's written down in a book, probably by some old dead guy, and may or may not apply to us. And really, like, when I see a law, like, my first thing, we deal with this with my oldest son, he's always trying to find loopholes in everything we tell him to do. And it's like, that's my fault, you know. I see a law, and I'm like, where's the loophole? I got to get out of this thing. Like, I can't, where can I find a way to get out of this law? But a command is something that is alive. A command comes from the voice of someone. It comes from the voice of the commander, right? I mean, imagine being out to battle, and the commander's like, hey, everybody, we need to retreat. And you go, I'm not going to listen to him. Well, you're going to be in trouble because everybody else is going to retreat and you're going to be captured, right? A command is something that is, it's alive. It's from the voice. It's from the mouth of someone, of something. In this case, of our Creator, who loves us, who cares for us, and who gives us these things to help us and to help change us. And so if we can view these as commands, these mitzvot, as something that's coming from the voice of God, and he's saying very lovingly to us, like, these are things that would really be beneficial for you to do, rather than laws that were like, that sounds really good, but I think I could get out of it if I did it this way, then it can really change how we approach this, this particular portion. I got this little sign here. I'm pretty pleased with that, right? Because we are on a journey, right? The idea of following the mitzvot is that we are on this journey towards bringing the spiritual into the reality of life. I was recently reading this book on, it's Agricultural Writings in America over the last 300 years, and I'm reading through the introduction, and the author was talking about how the reality of life is like, our world is trying to deteriorate the reality. And I realized that in the birth of the modern world, we've already killed the spiritual reality in life. Like, we've already decided, hey, there's not really a spiritual thing. Like, that's all kind of, that's ancient, that's old time. Like, we know things better now, and we know that there's not a spiritual. And now, as we are growing in a postmodern world, we're starting to try and erode at the actual reality of life. Like, hey, let's not go outside and experience what the world is like. Let's stay inside. Let's not experience things for ourselves. Let's watch other people experience them and show us what reality is. And these two things are actually, neither of them are gone. They're both still here. There is still a spiritual reality and there's still a physical reality. And they are both very intertwined. And when we observe the commands, the mitzvot, we are bringing the reality that's spiritual into the reality of our everyday physical life that we're a part of. But there can be two dangers as we go down this road of bringing these two things together, of bringing together the spiritual and the physical reality, of observing these commands, these things that the Creator has laid out for us in his word and in the Torah to do. For me, the danger tends to be legalism. I'm kind of a legalistic person. Even though I act like I don't like laws and rules and all these things, and I'm always trying to get out of them, I find myself wanting to be like, hey, I've put down a principle, and that's unbendable. We can't change that, and we're going to do it. And it doesn't matter what the circumstances or anything or how much I understand it, like, I've got to do this thing. I tend to be legalistic. For other people, on the other side, there is a spiritualization of the laws, and it would apply, but I sort of, it's covered with this other stuff. I wanted to share five things. I was actually surprised when I was looking through this and thinking about this, that there were five different things here that I realized, just on a personal note for me, as I have begun several years ago of going down the road of trying to obey the Torah and let the Torah be a part of my life, things that I have found that have been helpful for me, have been helpful for me to understand and to sometimes get it right and sometimes get it wrong, but identify, hey, I'm getting this wrong. I need to refocus. I need to recenter. I need to change. The first thing that that I have found that I believe is that when I observe, this is a two-parter, when I observe a mitzvah, I need to understand what I observe, but I also need to observe with the goal of understanding. I used to say, you know what? If I don't understand what God wrote in the Torah, I'm not going to observe it. I need to understand it, and when I understand it, I'll observe it. Because observing things that I don't understand, for me, was like, it just led to empty rules and legalism and, I'm doing this, but you're not. Right? But I was convicted that, man, there's many things that I might not ever fully understand, but I need to observe them too. And as I observe them, I need to ask the Lord, why am I observing this? What are you showing me? How am I growing? How is this changing my life, my marriage, my family, the people I work with? Right, so the piece of advice that I came along with is, if it doesn't make sense to me to observe a command or something, sometimes I take a quick break and I step back from it and I say, what am I doing here? Lord, help me to refocus. Help me to understand. What's the heart of this? Why do you have me doing this? And sometimes he says, it's not for you to know, but just keep doing it. And it's like, okay, I got it. I'll just keep doing it. And sometimes he shows me and he says, hey, this is why. And it helps me when I am observing to be like, I'm observing this, somebody else isn't, but they're really smart and they know a lot and I need to learn some things from them. Instead of, I'm observing this and they're not. I must be better than them. Number two, never write off any commandment as inapplicable, no matter how hard it may seem to put it into practice. There's a lot of things that we read in the Torah that it's either impossible to put into practice at this time or it's extremely hard to put into practice. That doesn't mean that it's inapplicable to us. Number one, because remember that everything that's written in the Torah, although it is written physically and to be obeyed and done in our lives, it also represents a spiritual reality. I want to stop and kind of say that again just to make sure that everybody understands what I'm saying. I am not saying that there are things in the Torah that, oh, it's there, but it's just spiritual. No. It is there. It is a command. It is to be lived out. It is to be done. But all of those commands represent something spiritual as well. So there is a spiritual truth. Even if we can't, if there's some reason why we can't fulfill it physically, or it seems to be something that's, you know, eccentric or out of the ordinary for us to fulfill, it still has a spiritual meaning to it. And as we investigate it on a physical level, we're also going to find that spiritual meaning. Secondly, some of these things just aren't applicable until the future, right? There isn't a temple right now. We aren't able to do some of these things. In the future, there will be, and we can. So it's good to know them and to know what is going on with them. Okay, number three. When trying to live Torah, remember that we are God's children and he loves us with grace. As I was thinking about this week, I thought to myself, you know, if all of my kids were in here, and I was up here, and my 18-month-old goes, dad, 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 in the middle of the teaching, probably everybody would giggle and think, oh, that's cute. He's 18 months old. He doesn't know any better. We'll kind of give him a bye, you know. Now, if my 11-year-old goes, yo, dad, everybody's probably going to go, that guy does not do a very good job with his kids, right? Like, he should know better. He's 11. He should understand the difference between when it's okay to speak and to not speak, right? The same is true with us. We are God's children. He is our Father, right? When he views us with grace, it doesn't mean that he excuses or says, oh, well, it's okay, right? Because my 18-month-old, I still want him to be quiet. I still want him to learn respect and reverence, but I understand that at 18 months, his ability to understand that is not as great as my 11-year-old's ability. Right? And Adonai understands with us that our abilities are at different levels to understand things as we're growing, as we're learning about him. And so as you look at these tons and tons of mitzvot and commands, and it's like, oh my goodness, I got to go after them. I got to do. Remember that the Lord is saying, hey, take it one step at a time. Learn one thing at a time. I think for me, the humbling part of this thought was that I had to say, man, I felt like I was like a 40-year-old Christian. Turns out I'm really like a 4-year-old follower of Yeshua. Right? Like the difficulty for me is the humility to say, well, Lord, I'm not as far as I thought that I was. I'm a little younger than I thought that I was. I'm a little less mature than I thought that I was. But I'm going to work on that. I'm going to get it better. And I think the Lord doesn't stand there and say, that's right, you're immature. Great job, though. Right? He stands there and says, great job for recognizing it. Thank you for seeing what I'm teaching you. Now go and do it. Mature, get better, grow more, learn more, do more. Number 4, follow the Torah, not the laws of man. Through this, we begin to know the heart of God and are able, like Yeshua, to do his work. Right? Yeshua says in John that he and the Father are one. He only does what the Father shows him to do. When we learn what the Father wants us to do through the Torah, we're able to do his work. Focus on what the Torah teaches, not on what man teaches or adds to it. Now, there's a lot of great stuff that gets added to this, and some of it is great, and it's like, yes, and some of it is not so great, and you throw it out. In our family, I just recently had this revelation as we've been celebrating and observing Shabbat every week at our house. A few weeks ago, I was on my way home, and our oven was broken, and challah and wine are a big part, grape juice for the kids, is a big part of what we do at Erev Shabbat. And I was like, man, it's like $6 for this loaf of challah at Giant Eagle. Like, I don't want to, that's probably like a bad expenditure of money. Like, I better not get it. And it was like all of a sudden the Lord inside of me said, this is important. This day, this time that I have set aside for Shabbat is important. If you don't want to buy yourself a donut earlier in the week, or you want to skip lunch earlier in the week, you go right ahead and do it and save that $6. But on Shabbat, you spend that $6 because this is an important time. Last night we were talking. A lot of times we like to eat Erev Shabbat outside on our back deck. And Rachel was like, well, I saw these candle holders at Target, and they would be perfect for our Shabbat candles outside, but they were like $9. And I was like, it's okay, it's $9. Just go out and buy them. It's important. Shabbat's important. Right? So sometimes things get added on to help us deepen our understanding or deepen our enjoyment or deepen our experience with something that God has given us. And that's a good thing. Sometimes they get added on and it hurts it. So we have to be careful to weed out. But that was for us the thing that we were learning in this season anyway. Number 5, you must follow the Torah in faith. Faith is that what it says is true, good, right, and brings life in your life. If we don't have faith that these things are right, then it's going to lead to legalism every time. Every time. We're just going to continue to observe things because we think we have to, or because other people do, or because we're told to. Right? We're not going to observe them because we think that there is a real reason to observe them. So we have to have faith in them. Unplaced faith can lead us towards a spiritualization. I've got faith that these things are right, but I've got faith that they've been taken care of and I don't need to observe them. I don't need to do them. That can also lead us. So we need to be careful, right? James, in James chapter 2, verse 17 says, "So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead." Right? So this, we need to put works, we need to put things to our faith and in observing the Torah and observing this. Okay, well, all of that to say, let's jump into our portion this week, starting in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 10. And it says in 21:10, "When you go out to war against your enemies." I read that and immediately was like, where did I see this already? And this seems really familiar. So I flipped back a chapter, and sure enough, there we are at the beginning of chapter 20, verse 1. It says, "When you go to war against your enemies." Oh, that's interesting. That maybe there's a connection here. So then I continued to read the portion, and as I got further on in the portion, in chapter 23, in verse 9, it says, "When you are encamped against your enemies." So it struck me that in all three of these occasions, it begins with this, when you are doing something against your enemies, right? Which just seems a little bit repetitive there. Like, go to war. Well, who would you go to war with? Well, obviously, I'd go to war against my enemies. Although sometimes I feel like I don't always go to war against my enemies. I go to war against the things that I think are my enemies incorrectly. So there's this idea. It's not actually redundancy, but it's clarification. Who are we to go to war against? Against our enemies, against the things that are bad for us. So each occurrence here of this when you go to war or when you go out has a different context attached to it. And you'll notice, too, with all three of these, it's not just a boom, 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 it's in order. It happens one right after the other. There's something that happens in between each of these things. There's separation between each of these things. And why is that? Well, let's look. These three occurrences, the first occurrence here is coupled with fear, right? Fear and a promise. Right? The first time we see it, it says, hey, when you go to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and armies larger than you, you shall not be afraid of them. Okay, the second occurrence is coupled with victory and responsibility at the beginning of our chapter, of our portion. When you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, and you take them captive, right? So it gives them into your hand victory, and you take them captive, responsibility. And the last time that we see it here in chapter 23, verse 9, when you are encamped against your enemies, then you shall keep yourself from every evil thing. Almost kind of a backwards order there when we get to that last one, because you think of yourself maybe being encamped and then going to war, but instead we're talking about fearing going to war, victory, and then backing up and saying, oh, by the way, and when you're encamped. And I think this third occurrence is coupled with walking in righteousness. Okay, so we notice it's not back to back. We don't have a clear one-shot picture here, but we have these things kind of divided up. And I think that these things can be divided up because that's how Moses experienced this stuff in his life. Right? It says here, when you go to war, right? We're all going to go to war at one point or another. We can either be prepared to go to war, prepared for this to happen, or it's going to take us by surprise, but it's going to happen that we're going to go to war in one way or another. I think that many times this war can be within us. It's the war against our own evil inclination, our own thoughts, our own minds. But many times the war can surround us. Many times I think the war can be the thing that we are best at. Not the war itself, but the war can be over the things that we are best at, the things that we are most skilled to do. Maybe even the thing that God's planned for our lives, for us. And our first response may be to shrink in fear from that war, to hide from it, to deny it, to try and get away from it. Right? Let's look at Moses. Moses was designated by God to be the liberator of the Israelite people. But Moses' first attempt to liberate the people, it didn't go well. Right? If you remember back in Exodus 2, Moses, he's living in the palace. He's been adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. And he goes out to see his people, and he sees this Egyptian taskmaster beating an Israelite slave. And he goes and kills the taskmaster. Like, yes! I'm going to liberate my people. And the next day, he finds out somebody saw it. It's a known thing. And what does he do? He shrinks in fear. And he retreats, and he goes off into the desert. And there's this great long pause in Moses' life before Adonai comes to him again and says, Moses, get over the fear. It's time for you to do the thing that you know you're supposed to do, that you've been designated to do. It's time for you to go do it. Now is the time. Right? So I feel like there's a little break in here as Moses is talking about this, because originally he's saying, hey, when you go out to war, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. This is why you don't need to be afraid. Because God's got your back. This is the thing that God wants you to do. Then there's this break, and he says, and when you wait, and when you do things within the timing that God has, you wait to work through that fear. Right? There was this whole list that Brad went through last week of all these reasons why men didn't need to go to war, because there was something more important that they needed to do. And sometimes in our life, there's something more important than that war that needs to happen first. There's something that needs to get taken care of before this happens. And we can get it all out of order, right? Like, I'm really bad at getting things out of order. My wife has to, like, help me and remind me and tell me, like, now is the right timing. Like, you hurt your back. Now it's time for you to go to the chiropractor. I'm like, no, it's not. I'm good. I don't need to go. And she's like, yes, now is the time. Right? Okay. Got it. Now is the time. Right? So Moses is giving this break. He's saying, work through that fear. Understand the right timing. Now is the time. Go. Go and do this thing. And when we do it in the right timing, when we do it when God wants us to do, to use that thing, the thing that maybe we're even called to do, we get success. We have victory because it's God going with us. Right? Remember the Israelite people? They're standing at the gate to the promised land, and the spies come back. And the spies, we can't go. It's so bad. We'll never do it. And then Moses speaks harshly to them and says, what are you doing? You've lost faith. What are you doing? And then the Israelite people say, we'll go. We'll do it. We'll do it. And they don't get success because they don't do it in the timing. I think they would have had success if they would have done it the first time, like God asked them to. But when they showed that fear, that doubt, those things, then God said, well, it's going to be another 40 years. And now here they are standing there again, and Moses is saying, hey, we've worked through this fear. We've worked through these things. Now the timing is right. Now we are going to see success. Trust in the Lord. He is going to give the victory here. And then in chapter 23, we see a little bit of the backdrop of this whole thing. It seems almost backwards to talk about the encampment after the victory. But in speaking of the encampment, we're seeing that the presence of Adonai is not just in the battle, but it's in the day-to-day. It's the presence of him in the little things. God can't be the God of the victory if he's not the God of the victorious people. Right? We can't expect God to be the God of our victory if he's not going to be the God of our lives. Right? We can't just say, well, I'm going to do whatever I want. Oh, hard time's coming up. Oh, God, deliver me from this. Well, maybe that hard time was brought on by something totally outside of what he had planned for you. And it's not to say that he can't and won't deliver and that he can't and won't do things, but we can't without fear march forward to do the things that God wants us to do if we're not willing to submit our encampment, what we do each day, to him. And to say each day we will work on having a clean encampment, that we will work on having things in order, that we will work on doing things the way that he wants us to do them. And we see this in this verse 10. It says, when you go out to war on your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, and you take them captive. The phrase here, on your enemies, that we see in here, could be on or on top of your enemies in the Hebrew. And the idea is that we need to be in a I don't want to say loftier, but in an elevated position when we go against our enemies. That we need to say we are conducting ourselves in light of the Torah, in light of the commandments, in light of his ways, in a way that we don't want to stoop down to do the things that they do. This whole section in chapter 20 and 21 and here in 23, it's all about an army that is so counter what any other army would be. It's so counter and so different of how any other army would exist that it says we need to be a different army, a different people that doesn't stoop down to the ways that our world says are okay, but lives in the ways according to what the Torah says is okay. Right, and we see this here as we proceed into these verses with in chapter 21. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you desire to take her to be your wife, and you will bring her home to your house. She shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall take off the clothes in which she was captured, and shall remain in your house and lament her father and her mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. But if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants, but you shall not sell her for money, nor shall you treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. How is the soldier who goes out to war, who takes captives, supposed to treat this woman that he encounters? Right? There's a thought here that probably this is not a beautiful woman in the terms of Proverbs 31, right? Proverbs 31:30, charm is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Right, the beauty of this woman is most likely not her fear of the Lord or something to be praised, but is more of a lustful beauty. During this time, a lot of the places where when you would go to battle, the women in the town would dress seductively and they would try to kind of coerce the troops to be distracted in the midst of the battle or in the midst of this campaign so that the town could gain the upper hand. Right, this is why it says that she's to remove the clothes that she is captured in, right? To remove the potentially seductive dress or these things and to be put into different clothes so that she can, her appearance, the outer beauty of this woman is changed, right? The Torah, but the Torah here does give us the allowance. It could be a woman of either beauty. Of either inner beauty or outer beauty. It gives us that ability. But it says to the soldier, take her home, have her shave her head, trim her nails, remove her captured clothing, and mourn for her parents. I think the first three are pretty self-explanatory. The Torah is saying, let her remove the outer beauty that you have found to think is beautiful, and then see what you think of her. The fourth one, I think, also, though, kind of speaks to this woman's heart. How is she going to mourn her parents? In what way? I think that says a lot about her character. Is it like, ah, or is it, wow, I've lost my family. My relationship with my parents was good. The things that were happening in my home and my family were good. So I think we're also testing the character of this woman as well in this. Well, most of the sages agree that really this whole process is more or less to get the soldier to say, you know what? You're right. I don't want to marry her. Let me just turn her on her way and she can go about her business and I'll go about mine. But the Torah does offer us the ability for the soldier to say, no, I was right. This is a beautiful woman. This is someone who is worthy of marriage and I will go in and be her husband and we will have a family together. But interestingly, the Torah goes on here in our portion in verse 15 and says, if a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both are loved, both the loved and the unloved have borne him children. And if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then on the day when he assigns his possessions as an inheritance to his sons, he may not treat the son of the loved as the firstborn in preference to the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. So interestingly, many agree that the unloved wife and the rebellious son kind of work as a picture going together, that if indeed you choose to marry this woman who you maybe probably shouldn't marry, you may find yourself in a situation of a loved and an unloved wife, which is going to cause a problem. And the result of that problem, or the product of that problem, may in fact be this next section in verse 18, the wayward or rebellious son. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, he will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. First, I want to note that there's never been a recorded case of this actually happening in the nation of Israel. And most rabbis today are like, and there won't ever be a recorded case of this happening. That's the thought process here. But this is in here. This is a part of what we see, and possibly a progression here of a bad union, an unloved wife, and now a wayward son. What is the wayward son convicted of? What is it here that we see that he's convicted of? What is it that's so bad about this wayward son? Any thoughts? Yeah, it's his obedience. And I looked at this and was like, you know, you begin to read it. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, I'm like, who else is stubborn and rebellious? I was like, well, the whole nation of Israel, which is kind of a picture of me, and I'm kind of stubborn and rebellious. And then I got to thinking about it, and I'm like, you know, stubborn and rebellious aren't necessarily in and of themselves bad character qualities. Like, we should to some extent be stubborn, right? Like, when we know something is right, we should be stubborn to stick up for what is right. If we know that we're in a bad situation, we should have an ability to have a little bit of rebelliousness that says, no, this is wrong. So it's not the stubborn and the rebelliousness. It's not these perceived character flaws that convict this wayward child, but it's the inability of this child to hear sound wisdom and to take corrective action or get corrected through the discipline. Right? We're not faulted for our stubbornness and our rebelliousness. We are faulted when our stubbornness and our rebelliousness is more important than listening, obeying, and being corrected by the discipline that God puts in our lives. That's a hard one for me. I don't want to be disciplined, and I definitely, when I'm disciplined, do not want to do what they tell me to do. But that is the wayward son. Right? We still have a place in the family as long as we're willing to obey and correct from the Father's words, to do what the Father says. Now, here's what's interesting. Think about this as a passage, right? We've said it flows from the beginning to the end, so we have this union that maybe shouldn't have happened between husband and wife. We have a loved wife and an unloved wife, and now we have a wayward son who is probably the son of the loved wife and the unloved wife together. And what does the passage say the father and the mother must do together in order to convict this child? They must go to the elders together. They must discipline the child together. They must correct the child together. They must teach the child together. They have to do all of these things together in order to get all the way to the end of this progression. I find that to be very hard to believe that that would happen if we're talking about a husband and an unloved wife. That they would be able to be in unity over this child and this child's death penalty if it's a husband and an unloved wife. Right? There's an important principle here with parenting. You've got to be on the same page as parents. We have to be in unity with our parenting, with our kids, in order to bring them up correctly and in order to see that. We see that in our family all the time. If the kids know that mom and dad aren't in unity at something, boy, they'll sneak right in there. And it causes trouble. It's mostly my fault when that happens, just confessing there. So, this idea of even just bringing this conviction, I think would be very difficult. The idea of even having a wayward son, if the parents are in unity and the parents are doing what they're supposed to do. Troublesome, yeah. Wayward, maybe not, is also probably not the case. Well, let's skip over that for sake of time, and we'll jump here to the end of our passage. Right, at the end of our portion, we're given this command concerning Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven, and you shall not forget. Notice this difference. At the beginning of our portion, we were to wage war against our enemies. And then we took some of them captive, and we had to figure out what to do with the captives. At the end of our portion, we are to wage war against Amalek. And we're not to take anything captive. We are not to even entertain the idea of taking anything captive. And we're not to forget to do this. Right? The first one may be a war of choice, like, let's expand our territory, let's go to war over here. But at the end here, this is not a war of choice. God's pretty clear. Get rid of Amalek. I want him gone. Don't forget. And I don't want him just a little bit gone. I want him all the way gone. I want him blotted out. I want him gone. And I think that there's a spiritual implication with these two bookends. First, there are things in our lives, our enemies, things in our life that we need to take captive. And we need to rearrange them, and we need to change them, and we need to figure out how they work right. And then they still become a part of our life. Right? Like Moses being the liberator. He knew he was the liberator, but he needed to have that rearranged. He needed God to show him how to be the liberator, how to lead the people out of Egypt, how to do these things. But on the other side, there are things in our life that are like Amalek. They're just bad, and we need to get rid of them completely. We need to blot them out from our life. We need to not entertain their thoughts anymore, not be at all involved with it and say, this is bad. We're going to get rid of it. We're going to blot it out. We are going to not let it be a part of our life. And so those two things are happening. And we need to discern. We need to discern between what are those things that need blotted out and what are those things that just, they need some correcting. They need some changing. And in the middle, between these two ideas, are these 74 mitzvot, these 74 things that the Lord says, hey, if you want to discern it, if you want to see how this works, if you want to know how to tweak it, if you want to know what to get rid of, like, try these things. They might help. They might be helpful. they might expound better on not stealing, not murdering, not coveting, not doing these things. They might help you in your daily life. I am so grateful for these things when I view them this way, because it allows me to not get caught in the weeds, like, oh, wow, there's just so much here, but to put an actual practical piece to everything. How do I love my brother? I look out for him. I return his ox to him. I take care of his things. I don't act like I don't have responsibility to him. I'm over-responsible towards him. How do I love my family? I'm in unity with my wife and disciplining and instructing my children and living that out. And then I reveal, too, parts that it's like, let's just get rid of that. I don't need that. Not a part of what I need to do. So I think there's just a great lesson for us, not only in our everyday walk, but spiritually, to realize what to root out and how to root these things out in our lives. So let me close us in prayer, and then we'll have Rick come up and lead us in the blessing. Adonai, we are grateful for your commands, the things that come from your voice as our creator, as our sustainer, Lord, that teach us what is good. Lord, strengthen our faith to believe that you are good in all that you command us to do and all that you tell us. Strengthen our minds to not be rebellious and wayward when it comes to your commands, but to listen to your voice, to take your correction and your discipline, to change the things that need changed, and to blot out the things that need blotted out in our lives, Lord. Lord, we bless you for just the blessing of a way of life that can lead to so much peace and to so much blessing. Lord, we bless you for being a great God who imagines far beyond what we can and gives us far beyond what we deserve. And we ask all this in Yeshua's name. Amen.
If you'll stand for the blessing. The blessing over the cup. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, borei pri hagafen. Amen.